This is made audio book of the Deep Wisdom Book, The Return of Arthur Conan Doyle. Edited by Ivan Cook, The White Eagle Publishing Trust, England. From the second edition. October, 1963. Chapter 1. How this book came to be written. Man has explored his world with some thoroughness by now. Neither land nor sea nor air seem to withhold their mysteries, and he makes plans to visit the moon and planets. There seems no limit to his ambition, no secret of nature able to withstand his search for knowledge, save only one, self-knowledge, for the knowledge of his own nature, his own destiny, his whence, why and whither, is denied to all but a few. Man is still largely ignorant of the background from which he came, if any. He sees no reasonable explanation of his own existence, or clear outline of what will happen to him when his mortal span comes to an end. With these same problems, students of religion, of philosophy, and in lesser degree of medicine and healing, have wrestled throughout the centuries, mostly in vain. This is why we are told by priests that man has to live by faith, that is, by an unflinching faith in what someone said many centuries ago, recorded in some book now held sacred, or else by faith in this or that interpretation of that book by some dignitary of this, that, or the other church. Such a faith is enjoined on man because, so he is told, there can be no other way of finding out anything about himself or his God. However, some progress at least has been made, if only in the domain of faith. We have evolved systems of morality, philosophy, conduct and religion that on the whole serve their community well enough. Yet one subject remains about which the average man not only knows nothing but expects to continue to know nothing, namely, his own future, and more important, the future of some loved one after death. Of all the mysteries, he believes, death is the most profound, the most unsearchable. This is perhaps why the Church has long declared that its God has purposely forbidden or debarred man from knowledge. Thus far and no further, said the Lord. This is ironical enough, for if death terminates everything forevermore, then man's having existed at all is a baffling, futile and often tragic mystery. Can this be true? For nothing is really worthwhile to us if the grave ends everything. Do we believe this? On the whole, no. We need no telling that so far as worldly wealth is concerned none of us can take it with us, but we still believe that there is an enduring yet imponderable wealth of the character, mind or spirit which might survive. To set forth why we believe this would deter most of us. We inherited our belief, perhaps, so that it has become part and parcel of our being. Because of some instinct or intuitive knowledge deep in us, we hold fast to this belief that something in us can and will survive because it is worthy to survive. The thought of extinction at death outrages our sense of rightness, fairness and justice. We feel that any decent man deserves decent treatment from his God. To snuff him out at death is not decent treatment, but why God should have forbidden us to inquire into these matters, as the Church has declared over the centuries, is puzzling in the extreme. What some of us really want, and want desperately to feel sure about, is not so much our own survival but a sure hope of reunion with those dear to us who have gone before. Without this, the idea of personal survival loses much of its attraction. No one wants to totter off to some ghostly location after death, there to wander alone while time drags on and on. We feel unwilling to participate in such a scheme of survival. Page 3. And yet whither can we flee for definite knowledge, for assurance in these matters? Surely, someone must know, perhaps one or other of those several great ones, on whose words and lives the sacred scriptures of the world are based, has told us. Astonishingly enough, it is not so. The various scriptures contain scant promise of personal survival or of reunion with those who have gone before. At first sight this will seem too heartless to be true. The Christian will ask, what about the resurrection of Jesus? Is not this both a promise and demonstration that all of us will survive death in a like manner? True enough, but can it be argued that what was possible for Jesus Christ, called the Son of God, is also possible not only to the Christian but to any and every man? Does this seem reasonable? The pick of the world's mountaineers can scale Everest by risk and effort. Could the man in the street? No. Neither can he climb far enough up the spiritual heights to warrant comparison with Jesus Christ. Neither do the four Gospels confirm the hope of the bereaved that they will rejoin their loved ones again in some better land. The church burial service, it is true, is made up of texts which seem to promise such happenings, but these are culled for that special purpose from the vast body of statements which constitute the Bible, and in any case it is possible to select another array of texts which promise nothing. The dead know not anything can be cited as typical of these, which can cancel out the others. Nevertheless, the hope and belief are prevalent that if there be a God of love, he will surely grant this desired reunion, and there the matter rests. Nor can it be said that the religions of the East are in much better case. They hardly mention survival, as an isolated fact. Karma, the sequence of cause and effect resulting in exact justice eventually and infallibly meted out to each soul, yes, and coupled with karma comes reincarnation, which is essential to such a plan. But we are not told what happens to the soul between its incarnations. Before karma can properly work itself out, not one but many lifetimes are required. The Bhagavad Gita is an impressive literary masterpiece setting forth this philosophy, and in its grandeur may bear comparison with the stellar universe itself, and yet also seem as distant and unapproachable to the average man of the West. Certainly there is little here to comfort the mourner with any promise of reunion. For in such philosophies a personal and human love is somewhat at a discount, and is cited as a form, modified perhaps, of desire for someone or something, and desire, we are told, is what the soul must get rid of at all costs, unless it is to remain on the ever-turning wheel of karmic desire and therefore of recurrent incarnations. Get rid of desire, it is said in the East, and once and for all the soul is forever freed of earth with all its sorrowful folk, and hears no more that cry of human sorrow which has no language but a cry. If there is little here to comfort the mourner, whither then must he turn for what he so desperately needs in the way of assurance and comfort in the hour of grief? Can any one of the more modern faiths assuage his sorrow? Theosophy, Christian Science, Spiritualism, what of these? It is well known that Theosophy is largely compounded from the various religions of the East, and as such presents both karma and reincarnation to its devotees, but not always in an attractive or most reasonable aspect. So also with the Theosophical doctrine of the afterlife, which appears to some chilly and unappetizing. Not here will the mourner find what he needs. So also with that which Christian Science proclaims concerning the afterlife, which is so seemingly contradictory that it is difficult to conceive of the average man, not a Christian Scientist, getting much help here. This brings us to Spiritualism as a last resort. If the churches and even their more modern variants have little to say about survival, and almost nothing about reunion beyond the grave, Spiritualism stands for almost nothing else but survival, and has as its dearest theme reunion beyond the grave. For here alone do we find evidence pointing to survival, proof of life after death, as against conviction based on faith. There is hardly any other evidence of this nature forthcoming. But, no one knows, the reader will say, if that evidence is worth anything, if it were really valid and true, practically everybody would accept it right away. Instead, everybody, or rather, most sensible people, simply will not have anything to do with it. The whole thing is continually being exposed in the press, considered much too foolish to take on trust, and in the past was denounced by the church. Quite so, all this may be true. What everyone is saying merits respect. Yet during all the centuries of mankind, man has produced nothing else capable of putting aside the sting of death. Without it, O grave, thy victory overrides every human being and wounds each loving heart. Even then, to establish survival and reunion is not enough. It does not carry us far enough. Of itself it is only one item of what we want to know. An average human life here is bitter and hard, and often seems to drag on far too long. Even when a man believes in the after life, when he waits and even longs for it, often it seems too much like by, in, there, sky which never comes. This is because survival by itself is by no means a complete religion. To couple this belief or surety of survival possessed by the spiritualist with any of the orthodox religions will not solve the problem. What does then? Only an orderly and reasonable explanation of man's being here on earth, only the purposeful setting forth of an outline or scheme which will go, relate this human life of ours with the life, or successive lives, which follows after death, only this can solve our problem of living rightly and dying hopefully and happily. The revelation of such a scheme is in fact the purpose of the present book, and this in as simple a manner as possible. Its theme falls naturally into three parts: the story of the events which brought about the revelation itself, the scheme of man's life here and its continuation in the hereafter, and finally an evaluation of the facts narrated. Chapter 2. The boy WHO became world famous. Every river has its tributary streams which discharge into its waters, and one or more of these can be claimed as the actual source of the river. This can also happen with a story, when several lesser stories just meander separately and then merge into the main stream. Thus, the present story might begin with the strange tale of the Hermit of Bagneo in 1908, on with the later career of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, or the early work of the well-known medium, authoress and seer, Mrs. Grace Cook. The lives of all three are inseparably interwoven in this story. But we naturally turn to that of the main protagonist in this book, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, doctor, novelist, playwright, creator of Brigadier Gerard and Sherlock Holmes, military historian, patriot, traveller, sportsman, supporter of humane causes, finally leader of the spiritualist movement and lecturer throughout the English-speaking world. His very life, his immense activity, and extraordinary personality have been the subject of three biographies since his passing in 1930. Even so, it may be that in these days the public have almost forgotten his variety and accomplishment, save only the fact that he created the modern vogue for the detective story. Page 7. As a boy, the present writer looked forward each month to the arrival of a monthly magazine bearing on its cover a picture of the Strand, London, with a handsome cab in the foreground, and a long vista of other horse-drawn vehicles. At the end of the Strand magazine were entrancing fairy stories by E. Nesbitt, sometimes about a creature such as was never seen on land or sea called a Samed. Also there appeared stories by one, Arthur Conan Doyle, concerning the adventures of Sherlock Holmes, ostensibly related by a Dr. Watson. Little did he realize that here before his very eyes were all but the first and certainly the very best of all detective stories, not to be equaled, far less surpassed by others in the subsequent spate of detective stories which they originated. Nor did the actual name Arthur Conan Doyle mean much to him until in later years he read his Stark Munro Letters, a book which is more or less autobiographical. Its author seemed so British in his uncompromising love of truth, sincerity, and enthusiasm for sport and action and love of country. Also he had the knack of catching and holding his reader's interest with the first sentence of a story, of bringing a character to life in a sentence or two. Not until years afterwards did it become plain that this vividness occurred because the writer was himself living in his characters, that he was born to his trade, and that his books were veritable expressions of himself. Also they were eminently readable because of their technical skill. Conan Doyle himself once said that his writing was at its best but plain English. But how plain an English was this? How forceful and sincere a style! It is not surprising that stories such as Silver Blaze and the Brigadier Gerard series came to be hailed as literary masterpieces of their time. Arthur Conan Doyle was born in Edinburgh on the 22nd of May, 1859. He died on the 7th of July, 1930. During his 71 years of vigorous life he wrote about 40 full-length books, several plays, a history of the South African War, and another of the First World War in 6 volumes, 2 major works, the writing of which might occupy a lesser writer for years, together with almost innumerable short stories of a quality which never flagged. His athletic achievements were no less notable. Page 8. He excelled at boxing, played cricket at Lord's, was a pioneer motorist, an expert at billiards, and the introducer of Norwegian skiing into Switzerland. It seems that whereas the ordinary man lives only a life half alive, this man lived throughout his days with a full 100% vigor and enthusiasm. Even during his last illness, Sir Arthur occupied himself by drawing a pencil sketch which he called The Old Horse, depicting himself as the old horse drawing the formidable load of his lifetime's achievement along a road where outstanding incidents of his career took the place of milestones. These included his school and university days, his adventures in a whaler, his medical practice, his mountaineering adventures, lecturing tours in America, activities during the Boer War, electioneering, and world tours as a propagandist for spiritualism. Piled to a colossal height on the wagon were hosts of his books, short stories, plays, and so on, together with a series of 500 lectures, the whole topped up by an array of golf clubs, boxing gloves, a cricket bat, billiard cues, skis, and other instruments symbolic of his love of sport. The picture was an epitome of his life, about which, as we have said, no less than 3 biographies have appeared since Iris' death. Yet the burden the old horse draws largely amidst the activity into which he poured his utmost energy, health, and finances, and which finally curtailed his life. This mission led him to deny almost everything that he had attained: wealth, ease, comfort, home, life, recognition and fame, even a peerage which was offered him, for the sake of an unpopular conviction which demanded all that he had left to give to life. We learn from his books that he had been interested in psychical research for many years. He had investigated several haunted houses and some poltergeist cases, and had met with startling experiences. "Starting," he says, "from a position of comparative materialism, I had at least become receptive and continued to investigate in the leisure hours of a very busy life. But when there, first world, war came, it brought earnestness into all our souls and made us look more closely at our own beliefs and reassess their values. In the presence of an agonized world, hearing every day of the deaths of the flower of our race in the first promise of their unfulfilled youth, seeing around one the wives and mothers who had no clear conception whither their loved one had gone, I suddenly seemed to see that this subject with which I had so long dallied was not merely the study of a force outside the rules of science, but that it was really something tremendous, a breaking down of the walls between two worlds, a direct undeniable message from beyond, a call of hope and guidance for the human race at the time of its deepest affliction." In this passage were expressed the writer's fearless confession of faith, and his conviction that here was the most important of all subjects open for man to study. Later came the additional conviction that here was something in the nature of a basic revelation. If death ended all for every person, then a person had lived for no purpose, since all his ideals, his hopes, achievements, affections, longings and the deep call of his heart for God all ended in extinction. So it must be with the host who had sacrificed their lives in Flanders. For if the individual man lived in vain, then Christ also had lived and died in vain, for man had no soul to save. So also with the other world teachers, equally vain were the various faiths or religions they had inspired. St. Paul's cry, "O grave, where is thy victory? O death, where is thy sting?" was meaningless. Without survival, all that remains for man is to practice some system of morality, such as that of Confucius, and systems of morality are cold comfort for the loss of 1 million men during a war which in itself constituted the breakdown of international morality. These were the realizations that spurred Arthur Conan Doyle onward. He was then the highest paid of short story writers, at the rate of 10 shillings a word, but now his income must go, except for an occasional short story, no more books must be written save on psychic matters, with survival as their theme. Boldly, trenchantly, he affirmed his new faith. Conan Doyle, went up the public cry of amazement, he, of all men, to believe in this sort of thing. It mattered little what people said. Everything had to go. Page 10. This was his calling, his crusade. Then began those tours, accompanied by his family, when the glad tidings had to be told across the world. For 11 years he drove himself on exhausting lecture tours through Australia, South Africa, America and Britain, never sparing himself, and latterly heedless of warnings by his doctors. No man in his 60s could stand the strain. One of the last acts of his life was to struggle up to London to head a deputation to the Home Secretary about the centuries-old law under which spiritualist mediums were prosecuted. Then came the end. Within a few days, the warrior was spent. His sword of the spirit was laid down at last. His remains were laid in the garden of his home near Crowborough, near the hut where most of his stories were written. It is said that the gathering was more like a quiet garden party than a funeral, for summer dresses were worn, and few people were in mourning. A huge crowd attended, and a host of telegrams poured in. A special train brought flowers. It seemed that his friends were world-wide. Thus was his body laid to rest. The flowers that had been sent covered the whole field. On the headstone was later inscribed his name, the date of his birth and four words, steel true, blade straight. Mr. John Dixon Carr's book, The Life of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, ends with these words, "Let no man write his epitaph. He is not dead, it is true." Both his name and reputation have survived. In almost every bookshop will be found omnibus volumes of his short stories, mostly the Sherlock Holmes series, and his books are frequently serialized over the air. Only books such as The White Company and Sir Nigel, and those about spiritualism have fallen into the background, and these were dearest of all to their writer. Those books of his which of entertainment value look like continuing for years to come, his deeper and more thoughtful books, not these. He is not dead. He lives on in these pages. Here is his final message. Chapter 3, Mine Esther. The late 1800s were the days of large families. To one of these a little girl was born, who came as the ninth child with a gap of 5 years between herself and the child before her. Her mother died when she was only 7 years of age, and the intrusion of death in so poignant a form at so tender an age left memories, which she has never wholly forgotten, of her own loss through death. Having felt the sting of bereavement so early, her sympathy with others in similar circumstances has always been keen, and her desire to help and comfort them strengthened. It appears that during her long illness the mother discussed with her husband the possibility of human survival after death, and the wife promised to communicate with him, if this were possible, after her passing. This for two staunch nonconformists living in Victorian days shows a certain enlightenment. Some time after his wife had passed on, the husband was taken by a friend to the home of a noted medium, Mrs. Annie Boddington. The two men sat at the back of the room, listening to the address, after which the medium gave clairvoyance, or spirit messages, to various persons in her audience. None came to the bereaved husband, but as he was unobtrusively leaving, the medium asked if the gentleman then going out would wait. He did so, and afterwards she came to him saying she had seen clairvoyantly that he had recently lost his wife, and that her spirit, waiting in the room to speak to him, had stood aside until the other people had gone, a form of timidity characteristic of her. Then the medium began to speak, as from the wife, giving the husband a message to each of her children by name, and showing by further evidence that she was conversant with all that had been happening in the home since her passing. What was so strangely convincing, however, was that while she was giving these messages the medium's hands were carefully arranging and rearranging the handkerchief in the husband's outside breast pocket, for this had always been a habit of the wife's. Can it be wondered that the husband returned home walking on air, with never a doubt that his wife had fulfilled her promise, and that he had spoken to her? His certainty was shared by all his children, then mostly in their late teens. Forthwith the whole family became spiritualists, and the father an ardent advocate and worker in the movement. In course of time he was speaking at one or other of the spiritualist churches or halls every week. Those were the days when to affirm oneself a spiritualist required courage. A spiritualist might be abused in the street, or even have missiles flung at him, while church services were frequently interrupted by stones coming through the windows or by bricks thrown onto the roof. Spiritualist mediums, moreover, were continually being prosecuted under an act for the suppression of witches dating back to the Middle Ages. Of course, the little girl, Grace, also became a spiritualist. At an early age, she attended the movement Lyceum or Sunday School, since when she has never wavered in her certainty of survival and reunion. This certainty, however, has not been based on messages received through other mediums, although she is familiar with this procedure, regarding it as natural and normal. Some are born to music, drama, painting or song, with gifts or faculties which are inherent and must be given expression if they are not to languish or die. Grace had perhaps the rarest faculty of all, for she was a natural-born psychic, with gifts of clairvoyance, of second sight or prediction, of spiritual sensitiveness, and of power to diagnose and heal sickness, which needed no developing, for they were spontaneous. These gifts were encouraged, of course, by her family's and her own familiarity with spiritualism. They might easily have been crushed had she been born into some harder, headed materialistic family. But their use to her was as natural as breathing, and they manifested spontaneously. She was no more than 13 when she gave a description and message to a woman, whom she had met for the first time, from someone who had died. She remembers telling the amazed woman that she was about to cross the seas to a distant land, where she would live in a house surrounded by a broad veranda on three sides. Afterwards, little Grace was told that she had described some dearly loved relative of the woman who had died, and given her a message she would never forget, especially as she was just about to return to her home in South Africa. One can imagine how impressive this communication must have been coming through a child who was a stranger. After her mother's death, Grace's life was none of the easiest. Her brothers and sisters were out in the world by now. Her father had married again, not very happily. She was left alone for long hours in a big house in a somewhat lonely part of South London, and being an intensely sensitive child, she was often frightened. But at such times a visitor whom she called the old man would occasionally come and talk to her and comfort her. She remembers that he did not look like an ordinary person but rather as if he carried some sort of light inside him. It shone out so that he seemed illumined. After he had been with her she would fall asleep and dream happily, and so natural did the visitant seem to the child that it was not until later that she realized that he was not actually of this world. Thus, though she lacked human society and made few friends of her own age, another order of existence offered her companionship. She grew to love that other world and her desire to serve its interests became a dominant factor in her life. So it was that in her late teens she appeared on the spiritualist platform to give an address and clairvoyance, and as the simplicity and youth of the exponent created something of a sensation she was asked. In the years that followed, to speak at other centers. Eventually a week rarely passed without several of these engagements. This was hard work, for it involved journeys about and across London, and also to provincial towns or cities such as Birmingham, Edinburgh or Glasgow. In fact, most of such engagements meant a wearisome Sunday journey, the giving of an address and clairvoyance, an even more wearisome return home, with little more in the way of material recompense than enough to cover expenses. This called for devotion to a self-imposed duty over a number of years. It was worthwhile, for the effort developed qualities of courage and steadfastness which were to fit her for the work that lay in the future, and brought her even nearer in spirit to her teacher and guide. Every medium, it is said, has a guide, or doorkeeper, in the unseen world who acts as guardian, counselor and friend. These are often colored folk, and this may seem strange to the Westerner who is convinced that some white, skinned person would do just as well or better. But the Westerner is apartment to concentrate on intellectual development rather than intelligence, and there is a difference between these. Indeed, it is often the case that the more highly developed a man's intellect, the less intelligent he is.